ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. In this week's episode, we're going to be honoring actress Olivia de Havilland, who turned 100 on July 1st. Olivia de Havilland was born in 1916 in Tokyo, moving to California with her parents and sister, actress Joan Fontaine, in 1919. Olivia de Havilland made her acting debut in Alice in Wonderland on the stage, before transitioning to cinema in 1935, with her feature film debut in Max Reinhardt's A Midsummer Night's Dream, reprising the role of Hermia that she'd perfected in the stage version.
Ladies and gentlemen, I know it isn't polite to intrude one's private life upon other people, but I would like to tell you why I think I'm the luckiest girl in the world. When an actress gets what is called in Hollywood a break, which means that she decides her first book, it isn't very often that she's allowed to play in a large production. Therefore, you can imagine how amazed I was when they told me that Max Reinhardt was going to let me play the part of Hermia in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And Max Reinhardt, as you know, was the greatest genius of all directors. This great Shakespearean classic represents a glorious effort to produce a picture which will influence the entire future technique of the talking screen. Its beauty, its lavish mounting, and its unbelievable photographic effects can't possibly be described adequately. I do hope you'll see it, and then perhaps you'll forgive me for having intruded now to tell you about it.
She started out playing ingenues before finding her niche and her on-screen compatriot, Australian actor Errol Flynn. De Havilland and the Tasmanian Devil would ultimately star in 9 features together.
Ah, oh, there's an archer. No, he's too thin. I might miss him altogether.
Robin.
The very thing. 5 men-at-arms talking in a group. They'll break the fall beautifully. Goodbye, my lady.
Robin.
Yes?
Please.
Then you do love me, don't you? Don't you?
You know I do.
Well, that's different.
You are. And when my real guardian, King Richard, finds out about your being in love with me...
I know. He'll make me court jester.
You won't. He'll stick your funny head on London Gate.
Her immortality was cemented in 1939, when she starred as the demure Melanie Wilkes in Gone with the Wind. After that, de Havilland exploded, dividing her time between film and the stage. In 1947, de Havilland, fed up with Hollywood Studios' abuse of stars' contracts, sued Warner Brothers. In a landmark decision known appropriately as the de Havilland decision, the California Court of Appeals decided that a contract's demands of 7 years meant 7 calendar years, not 7 years with some suspensions and other ways to tack on additional time. It actually abolished the studio's technique of adding more years if a star wasn't compliant.
And they said, we want you to talk to, well, Martin, to talk to you about your situation. He thinks there's a way out. So Martin explained that there was a California law which limited the right of an employer to enforce a contract against an employee for more than 7 years. And that no actor had dared to take advantage of the law by asking for declaratory relief, which is to say an interpretation of the law as it applied to an actor's contract. We went into court first, the Superior Court, Judge Charles S. Burnell presiding, in November of that year, 1943. And it is true that Warner Brothers' lawyer did put me on the witness stand. And they said, be very careful, because he will try to make you angry and try and make you appear like a spoiled movie actress. And, oh, he was so wicked. Oh, gimlet-eyed. And he would say, accusingly in thunderous tones, is it not true, Mr. Havilland, that on such and such a date, you failed to report to to the set to play such and such a role in such and such a film. And I'm remembering Martin Gang's instructions said, I didn't refuse, I declined. So all this time, the judge, I noticed that the judge, he had his hand in front of his face, and I couldn't figure out whether it was his spectacles that were twinkling or, in fact, his eyes. But he, we certainly had his attention, and I thought maybe I have a little hope here. I think maybe I have a chance after all. And indeed, about 3 months later, or more than that, it was March of 1944, around the 15th of March, I was up on the island of Adak and the Aleutians visiting the patients in the military hospitals. Someone came to me, a soldier, and said, we have a telegram for you. Well, this was really quite extraordinary up there in wartime. And it was from Martin Gang. And it said, you've won in the Superior Court.
The de Havilland decision was the first attack to the studio's control of its stars, and allowed performers to seek out better projects. Olivia won 2 Academy Awards for To Each His Own in 1947, and The Heiress in 1950. Ultimately, she was nominated 5 times. She also has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and received the National Medal of Arts. Today, she lives a quiet life in France after retiring from films in 1989. The first time I saw Olivia de Havilland was probably in Gone with the Wind, and though I have many issues with the so-called greatest movie on earth, de Havilland took a rather one-note character and imbued her with warmth and sensitivity. It's really hard to hate her because she's just so sweet and innocent. The first time I was left speechless by her, though, was in The Heiress. Sure, the idea of making a beautiful actress look frumpy is nothing new, just as Betty Davis in Now Voyager, but de Havilland's transformation from idealistic wallflower to hardened cynic left me dazzled and amazed. Then again, who could blame her for being a bit bitter over a man like Monty Clift? From there, I've taken in de Havilland's work with Errol Flynn, and I have a list of titles I still hope to sit down and consume. Olivia de Havilland is just one of those otherworldly actresses. There's no one else like her. But I guess you could say that about most stars from the classic period. But she's just lovely, and it's amazing that she's still with us at 100 years old. So happy birthday, Olivia.
Olivia de Havilland, winner of the Academy Award for To Each His Own, acclaimed for her arresting performance in The Snake Pit, now confirms her position as dramatic queen of the screen with her poignant and unforgettable portrayal of the heiress. One of the outstanding Broadway stage hits of the decade, The Heiress was adapted from Henry James' penetrating novel of a woman who cast aside all the conventions she lived by to hold the man she wanted.
He must come. He must take me away. He must love me.
Catherine, you must take hold of yourself.
No, no, Morris must take hold of me. Morris will love me. For all those who didn't.
In honor of the great Olivia de Havilland's centennial, my special guest and I are going to be discussing our top 3 favorite films starring the birthday girl. I'd like to introduce Nora Fiore. Nora, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me here, Kristen. You might know me online as the Nitrate Diva. I tweet and write about classic films with special fascination in film noir and pre-code. But just about any classic film, I'll watch it, whether it's really, really bad or really, really excellent. In honor of Olivia de Havilland's 100th birthday, I've started the hashtag Oliviathon. I am watching her filmography in entirety, starting from the beginning and working in roughly chronological order through her later films, which will be airing also on TCM in the end of July. It's been a lot of fun so far, and I feel like I've turned up a couple of hidden gems.
Do you recall the first movie that you watched Olivia in?
Oh boy, that would probably be Captain Blood when I was a little girl. My dad bought the DVD because he loved swashbuckler movies and wanted to show it to me, and I really do remember being very invested in her and invested in her chemistry with Errol Flynn. Especially, it was just so nice to see a heroine who was so spunky and who had such a sense of attraction to the leading man. You know, a lot of times heroines are so passive, but I feel like she always worked in this sense of, like, she's pursuing the leading man as much as he's pursuing her, and I really liked that.
Well, let's start the countdown. We're going to start in reverse order with number three. Nora, since you are the guest, I'll let you start.
I wanted to make it clear, though, that the movies I'm listing are not the movies I necessarily would say are her greatest films. They're more the ones that I enjoy the most. And I would probably say It's Love I'm After would be my number three pick, because it's a film of hers I think gets overlooked a lot. It's absolutely hilarious screwball comedy starring Leslie Howard, Bette Davis, and of course Olivia. And it's wonderful to see three of the greatest dramatic screen actors ever. You know, I mean, Bette Davis, Leslie Howard, I mean, Olivia de Havilland, these actors who would go on to have these big important roles in some of the most monumental dramas Hollywood ever produced. In It's Love I'm After, it seems like they're having a lot of fun. Leslie Howard is this Casanova actor who's always having affairs and that his stage team partner Bette Davis doesn't like at all. For me, Olivia just steals the show as this rabid fangirl who is obsessed with Leslie Howard and will just go to any lengths to try to get to marry him, which is very difficult for him to resist since he's trying to be faithful to Bette Davis. It's just, I think it's a really underrated screwball comedy. It's just a hoot from beginning to end. And I think any fangirl of any stripe will be able to identify with Olivia's character, who's really, really funny.
I don't ordinarily like Leslie Howard films. Just as an actor, I find him to be very, very dry. But I'm interested in that one purely from the plot perspective.
If you haven't seen it, I would definitely recommend it. It's a very, I have to say, I feel like people underestimate all three of those actors' comic talents. And Leslie Howard was very funny. Have you seen The Stand-In?
I have not.
I think it's on DVD, but he's very funny in that too. He definitely got a lot of these roles that I know even he didn't like Ashley Wilkes. He hated Ashley Wilkes because it was such a stoic, almost a very weak role. He doesn't initiate any action. Things just happen to him, and I know he hated that. So I think his acting, definitely comedy brings out a different side of him, and I would definitely recommend It's Love I'm After, and if you can find it anywhere, because I think it's not on DVD, The Stand-In is also great.
Well, my number three, like Nora, I didn't really have criteria in terms of trying to identify the best, and I would say that I haven't seen as many of her films as I probably should have by this point. My number three is 1938's The Adventures of Robin Hood. This is kind of perceived more as an Errol Flynn film because he's Robin Hood, but for me, I really appreciate Olivia de Havilland more for just being a woman in this world that is so hyper-masculine. She's mm-hmm. tough, but she's demure. She saves Robin Hood more than once, and she's willing to go out into the woods in that long dress and veil. A testament to her abilities to make all of that look very effortless. Is more of her iconic film roles, not on par with something like Gone with the Wind, but definitely one of those top three films. But I love it more just for watching her play this character that could have been very, very marginalized and doing something with that.
I agree completely, and I think you express it beautifully, especially the way she, in all of these costumes, which must have been very cumbersome. I've seen some short behind-the-scenes footage of filming in Sherwood Forest, and there's a clip of her in her street clothes, and then which looked very smart and 30s and cool and, you know, like what you would wear, in a California forest. And then you see her in this heavy, long dress, and yet she always looks poised. She always is full of sass and full of humor and just right on the beat on all of her lines. And I really love what she brings to the role, so I'm glad you chose that one.
I would say she's almost kind of a precursor to, if anybody's seen The Court Jester with Danny Kaye, the Glynis Johns character, who is very much kind of that Maid Marian, only also a spy as well. I think we wouldn't have that character without Olivia de Havilland as Maid Marian. Nora, what is your number two?
My number two would probably be Hold Back the Dawn. Now, this is a recent discovery for me, and it is unfortunately not on DVD because it is a Paramount film, which I believe is owned by Universal. And don't get me started on film distribution or lack thereof these days. But it's this marvelous film from which was a loan out for her, because the roles she got at Warner Brothers in the mid-40s were not very rewarding, and her best roles oftentimes were loan outs. And this is a loan out to Paramount. Hold Back the Dawn is a drama about an immigrant on the Mexican border. He's Romanian, played by Charles Boyer, who's very posh and sophisticated. He's a gigolo. And in order to get into the United States, which is his, you know, really what he wants in order to make a living, and so he thinks he can work a much better hustle in the United States, he has to marry an American. And who should come over the border for a 4th of July ceremony but little school teacher Olivia de Havilland, who is just the easiest of prey for him to make her fall in love with him. But what he doesn't anticipate is that he falls in love with her, too. It's a beautiful film. It was written by Charles Brackett and Billy Wilder. So it has this, you know, the dialogue just that you could feast on all this, these memorable lines. And it's wonderful to hear her speaking that kind of really quality dialogue that I think in a lot of her films, she stock characters. She's really making more out of the lines than what are there. But I feel like in Hold Back the Dawn, she gets a role that was really worthy of her. And it's very moving what she can do with this part, and how she can sell the redemptive arc of the male character, because you might not believe it if she didn't bring so many unexpected qualities to this little small town school teacher. It's not just that he feels sorry for her, it's that he sees in her a spark of goodness and of hope and of acceptance that moves him to become a better person.
And I do believe TCM is actually screening that in the next couple of weeks for her birthday. You're right, it's not available on DVD, and I think part of Paramount is owned by Warner's, but then part of it is also Universal. I don't know how Paramount divides their catalog, but it's
a nightmare. But yes, definitely anybody who's listening, make time for Hold Back the Dawn, set your DVRs, because it is a beautiful film, and I think you'll really love it.
Well, my number two is probably Olivia at her strangest. It's the 1964 Robert Aldrich film Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. This one was a fun discovery for me. Aldrich infamously directed Betty Davis and Joan Crawford in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane 2 years before this had come out, which kind of ushered in this genre of films known as hagsploitation, which was taking beautiful actresses and kind of bringing them low as the 60s and 70s went on. And everybody did this for the most part who was still working. Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Jennifer Jones, they all have these weird Grand Guignol-esque films that they tried to kind of capture the zeitgeist as the 60s transitioned into the 70s. And they're all not good, but they're all worth watching in various ways. And Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte was meant to be another team-up between Crawford and Davis, but a mystery illness, quote-unquote, sidelined Joan Crawford, and Olivia de Havilland was brought in as this replacement, and I actually think that makes the film better. It tells the story of Betty Davis, who is this Southern Belle recluse who has witnessed a horrid crime. Her house, they want to sell it, and her cousin Miriam shows up one day, who is played by de Havilland. Because you're not used to seeing Olivia de Havilland play anything beyond the sweet and sensitive regal woman, you're not really expecting anything other than the straightforward, whether it's Betty Davis going insane or something. You have these preconceived notions of these actresses that had it been Joan Crawford and Betty Davis, you would have already been able to kind of deduce what the film would have pulled. But because it's Olivia de Havilland, you're not on sure footing. It's very much a fun film. You can see that Olivia de Havilland is having the time of her life with this movie, and the audience is really in a false sense of security, and I won't spoil the rest. To me, it proved that Olivia de Havilland had way more in her other than playing the romantic interest or the dramatic actress. She had this ability to be mean and to be the villain, which I don't think anybody ever gave her the chance to be, which part of that was how deeply ingrained persona was with actresses at that time period, villainesses had very strict looks. You don't really expect that with Olivia de Havilland. I love that the movie really surprises you with her performance. She has a lot more going for her in this movie. And the first time she said the word bitch in this film, I gasped out loud because I was like, Olivia doesn't have language like that in her. It was very shocking, but it's such a fun film. I don't think it gets the credit that it gets, especially in comparison to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is very much high camp, very macabre. This is a quieter film, but that sense of unease and decay is still present. It's just muted and wrapped up in this southern sentiment that is very enjoyable. And Twilight Time is putting it out on Blu-ray, I think, in July or August, and I'm very, very excited to own it. If you've seen Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, you really like that. You have to kind of see the spiritual sequel almost.
I really like Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. I've always felt like it was a kind of classier grade of hagsploitation. Like, sure, there are some of those moments that you can tell are thrown in there for shock, and there's some stuff that's a little corny at times. But I've always liked it because, to me, it felt like they took one of those melodramas from the 40s that Bette Davis and Olivia de Havilland would have been in and just kind of took the logical extension of that. What if those melodramas they were in, what if something like In This Our Life didn't have a happy ending? What if those tensions had just kept festering and festering and festering until we see these people 20, 30 years later? How much more would that be deeply ingrained and gone to very dark places?
Exactly. It's very much kind of taking that veil off of classic old Hollywood and saying, amongst the beautiful dialogue and the costumes, this is what people really look like. This is what people are really thinking when they're saying stuff to your face. Nora, what is your number one?
It's funny you mentioned Olivia being a villain, because one of my favorite, if you ask me another day, I might give a different pick, favorite shift, but I would probably name that as The Dark Mirror, in which she does play a villain as well as a heroine. She plays twins, and it is a really exceptional performance. She made it in 1946 after she had won her battle against Warner Brothers and was free to take the roles that she found creatively rewarding. And I can only imagine that this was very rewarding for her to create not one, but two completely fascinating individuals, Terry and Ruth. Ruth is very sweet and delicate and fragile and caring and warm. She's sort of like the archetypal Olivia de Havilland role. And her sister could not be as far from that. Terry is mean and vicious, but very subtle, has this very sensual aura about her that you can tell she's a very aggressive, pointed person and very scheming. And it's just wonderful to see her sometimes within the same frame playing these two completely different people with different vocal tones, with different postures, different mannerisms, just everything about these two women, in spite of the fact that they are identical and played by the same actress, obviously, is opposite. It's really a fascinating performance. And the other fun thing about it is that it's a film noir. And when you think film noir, you think Barbara Stanwyck, you think Ava Gardner, you think, you know, there's a number of actresses that come to your mind when you think of film noir. Olivia de Havilland is not one of those actresses, so it's fascinating to see her inhabit the world of noir in this extraordinary double role.
The Dark Mirror is one of those that I really do want to see. There was that love of twins in the 1940s. Bette Davis also played twins. My number one is the one she won one of her Academy Awards for, and it is The Heiress from 1949. Based on Henry James's Washington Square, Olivia plays Catherine Sloper, an old maid with a substantial inheritance, and sparks fly when she meets Montgomery Clift's Morris Townsend. But the audience is wondering if Morris loves Catherine or her money. For me, this is a very somber drama, but it's just so swoon-worthy. Mostly because of how Monty Clift plays Morris. This was also a test for him as well. He had kind of wanted to portray himself as this method actor, and there's a lot of stories about how difficult he was to work with because he really wanted to get into the character. As Morris, yes, the character requires someone who's gorgeous, and at that time, who was more beautiful than Montgomery Clift, but there's this insidious, manipulative quality to him that you understand why someone like Catherine, not because of her looks or anything, but just because of who she is, would be duped by him. He's the master con artist. And as somebody who just loves Olivia de Havilland, I think she did so much with a role that could have just been, can she act and be unattractive? Her beauty shines through, regardless of the eyebrows and the dour clothing. She's so idealistic, and she believes in love. And you want her to succeed because she needs this bit of freedom. She's controlled by all these men around her. She wants to believe in something that she creates herself, whether it's the ability to be her own person or just to attract a man for herself and not for what she's worth. So the final scene in this film is just her at her best, and it's also the saddest moment I think I've seen in a classic film that's not somebody overtly dying. It's an amazing tour de force performance from her, and I love it so much. This movie never gets tiring for me because even though you know the ending, Olivia de Havilland makes you believe what you want to believe. You want to believe alongside her, and it's a beautiful movie. I love it so much.
I agree. I think it's a masterpiece and one that would not exist without her. You know, like Lillian Gish at a certain point in her career was picking her directors and picking her vehicles and really count her as, in many ways, the auteur of some of her films. It's the same with Olivia's later films. She picked the project when she saw it as being performed as a play. She kind of had a short list of directors of which Wyler was available. While it is Wyler's vision, it was her impetus that brought us that film. And it really is an extraordinary film and an extraordinary emotional transformation.
It is the perfect blend of, and I keep saying persona, but it really is true, because if you had had somebody like Bette Davis playing that role, mind you, Bette Davis did play debutantes and heiresses in other films, mm-hmm. She would have come off as far too strong-willed. She would have seen right through Montgomery Clift's personality traits. Olivia, you understand that she's not stupid, but you still want to have those blinders on like she does. It's a great pairing of actress and role. So I'll throw out any honorable mentions. This will be the time to just chill for Olivia de Havilland films.
Oh man, that's hard. There's so many good ones. I have to say I've been enjoying her comedies. Four's a Crowd is probably the least well-known film she made with Errol Flynn. She made it in 1938, the same year she made Robin Hood. And it's another screwball comedy. It's very charming. Well, I won't give away what's odd about it as a Flynn de Havilland partnership, but if you watch it, you'll see. But she plays the stock screwball comedy character, the Daffy heiress, and she gets to do all these funny things like dance around her room while, you know, throwing sheets around, or you know, be talking on the phone while being on an exercise machine. She gets to play up the very kind of scatterbrained 30s role. So it's fun to see her in that kind of light role. I love A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I think it's amazing to watch that film and think that that was the first film she shot, even though Alibi Ike and The Irish in Us were released after that. So it's not listed as her first film, A Midsummer Night's Dream. It was the first film she shot, and she is just so radiant and plays so beautifully with the camera, and she's handling Shakespeare like it's her daily speech. I mean, she just is such a pro, and it's frightening to me that Warner Brothers didn't say, let's give this girl the best we got, you know, that they didn't recognize the value and the maturity already in her as an actress. That's another good one. I'm kind of about halfway through my rewatch of her filmography, so maybe I'll have a few more in a few weeks. But
I have several to watch still, and I would also throw out Captain Blood, which you mentioned. I think her films with Flynn are so fun, even though they have so many different locations. They never get old, regardless of the fact that they work together 9 times. I also really like Dodge City. I'm not big on westerns. A, this movie's beautiful to look at. Her and Flynn have this great rapport, and she plays a rather progressive woman in the West who is a writer and doesn't want to write about women's things. It's just a different way of kind of subtly saying that women want to do something different, and she's not pushy enough to make it come off as threatening, but she's still bringing it up. I think we both agree Gone with the Wind is necessary, But I will maintain that I do not care for Gone with the Wind at all, for a multitude of reasons that I won't throw out here, but she is very, very good in that film, as well as everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfectly cast film in so many ways, and while a lot about it that makes it hard to watch, it's never going to be among my favorite films, but I kind of had a big turnaround when I watched it recently. I was just struck by how extraordinary the cinematography is and just all the performances. So it's, you know, it's worth watching and giving your time and energy, and that's a lot of time and energy just for that.
Well, of course, if you kind listeners have favorites that we didn't touch on, you can feel free to email them to me at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. Nora, I'd love to thank you again for joining me today. Once again, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Well, I'm at Nitrate Diva on Twitter, and my blog is nitratediva.wordpress.com. You can see plenty of Olivia-related tirades and fangirling on both of them at the moment. Can I just thank you also? It's an honor to be here, and I really appreciate it.
And that's going to close out this week's edition of Ticklish Business. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysandclassicfilm.com. Next time, I'll be joined by another guest as we honor TCM and Fathom Events' latest big screen event, 1968's Planet of the Apes. Until next time, everybody.